am a parent of three children, and what I can do is invest myself in having my children look good so that I look good. And you know, I can accomplish that. I could, if I really tried hard, make my children look good. But what use is it? When I die, it's all gone.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Well, Jack, last week, if I remember correctly, I was standing on my soapbox and yelling loud and clear about some issues that are just very essential and very important to me. The subject that we were on was, a Christian, a believer, has a growing understanding of God's creation. And that kind of sounds rather innocuous, but we said some things that were very, very important and vital in terms of how we look at life, and that will very much affect how we live life. Okay, so that's kind of a vague review of what we did last week, and I really would encourage people to look back at that. But one of the areas that we wanted to look at just a little bit more is that in our growing understanding of God's creation, we need to understand that the world is not permanent, that it's passing away.
Right. Yeah, last session we looked at the inherent futility of the world, the emptiness, the hollowness of the world, so that even if it were everlasting, even if it were permanent, it really wouldn't be satisfying. It wouldn't match the longings of my heart. But in addition to not being fulfilling, it's also not permanent. And for a number of places we could point to where the New Testament writers or the biblical writers point to that, but one really notable example is in 1 John. John says, "Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. Now the world is passing away, and also its lusts, but the one who does the will of God abides forever." There's a lot we could talk about in there, but the point that I wanted to bring out in this, relative to our topic, is the last sentence there. The world is passing away, and also its lusts or desires, but the one who does the will of God abides forever. He's just trying to make this contrast between, if I invest my life, my existence in the stuff of this world, the things that are desirable in this world, if I go for that and try to attach my meaning to that, how foolish it is, because this whole world is going to be gone. It's going to be nothing. It's going to be reduced to nothingness. But the one who invests his life in being rightly related to God and does the will of God, that's the one who's going to abide forever, he says. So in terms of lasting meaning, there's no choice.
Does that mean that investing in God, does that mean that I go to church every Sunday, that I pray a whole lot, that I have quiet times, that I worship the Lord? Is that what you're talking about, Jack?
No, not primarily, although it could translate into any number of those things. But it has to go deeper than that. It has to be something that, just from the core of who I am, I have looked at life and reality and my own existence, and I've determined that I have a creator who really ultimately controls my whole destiny, and I need to know that creator, and I need to understand him, and I need to be rightly related to him. And that's going to affect my attitudes toward life, the choices that I make, my perceptions of life, my judgments. That's the level at which I really know whether somebody knows God. Not the surface of their life, but the depths of their life.
let's try and make this really practical because it's a hard thing. You know, I think that it's easy to say, okay, what I'm going to do is now invest. Well, it's not so easy, but I could finally come to the conclusion, okay, now I'm going to invest myself in pursuing God and understanding Him and not pursuing the things of the world. Okay, I'm going to rev myself up for it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. But the reality is, Jack, that it's really tough to do that. We're really blinded. We don't really see lots of times when we aren't investing ourselves in pursuing righteousness and pursuing God and pursuing those kind of things, because we are so tied up to what's going on in the world here and now. We have to sleep. We have to eat. We have to get up and go to work in the morning. We come talk on radio shows. You know, we're just doing so much that our life is a great deal taken up by the nitty-gritty of just getting through life. So it's kind of hard to have this, I think it's very hard to have this different perspective. And how in the world do I accomplish it through my life?
Well, I think we have to remember the context in which we're having this discussion, and that is the activity of the Spirit of God in my life to sanctify me. That is to bring about some changes in my desires and my changes in my understanding, to change my perceptions, to change my values. It's so seductive, it's so tempting to try to think in terms of what can I do to change my life? But the biblical perspective is really nothing. You can't do anything to change your life, but your Creator can. The one who created you to begin with can recreate you. The one who gave you being and gave you existence can alter the nature of that existence, can change your perceptions, can change your passions, can change your desires, and so on. Well, it's in that context that we're looking at how should we view the world. How will the child of God view the world? The only thing I can do ultimately, or the most important thing I can do ultimately, is to flop down on my face before God and say, God, help me. God, change me. God, have mercy upon me. God, make me see. Give me the eyes to see. And then, as I go through life, try to be ruthlessly honest, ruthlessly realistic about my life. Don't lie to myself, don't deceive myself, don't kid myself. Be as honest as I can be. Now, I'm only going to be honest by the grace of God, as God produces that kind of honesty in me. But
isn't that a partnership that we're talking about? It isn't that I do nothing. It's just I do a lot in response to the Spirit of God working inside of me. He's prompting me to be honest. He's prompting me to want good. And I'm responding to that. And that's what you mean by being ruthlessly honest, I think.
Right, right.
Really working at being aware of and working with the things that God wants in my life.
Right.
Whether I hear that through the prompting of the Spirit, whether I hear it in teaching that I get or study of the Scriptures, but I'm working with what God is giving to me.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a valid way to put it. The partnership imagery can be really misleading, and I don't. This may take us someplace where we really don't need to go today. But you know, I suppose in a way, what I want to say is it's 100% the activity of God and 100% my activity. It's not 50% mine and 50% God, or 75% God and 25% mine. You really need to look at it at two levels. On one level, I am disciplining myself to let truth be truth and let right be right and let good be good, and these are all choices that I'm making, and they're 100% my choices. But how could I possibly have the wherewithal to love what is good and right and true and so on if it weren't for the activity of God in my life to kind of recreate me and remake me and rewire me in very important ways? So it is a cooperation, and it feels like that at times, in that God will use my circumstances where it looks like God is setting me up to learn a lesson and then just kind of sitting back and saying, okay, what are you going to do with that, Jack? And then I have to decide, do I want to see the truth here, or do I want to run from the truth? Do I want to be wise here, or do I want to be comfortable here? And in that sense, it feels like a partnership.
Usually what I want to do is be comfortable and not wise. Mm-hmm. And I want to run, and I don't want to see the truth. Or at least initially, that's what I do. Last night, we were having a meeting, a kind of a family meeting, Sunday meeting. Don't get me wrong, listeners. We're not a real great family. We don't have family meetings every Sunday night. We've tried, and they don't work very well. Here's a great example. I don't want you to conjure images that just aren't real, like we have this great, serene family where everything's just working nice and everybody wants to get together as a one big happy family with teenagers. That's not true. About 9 o'clock last night, finally when the dinner was over and the dishes were finally done and the fights were over with the dishes, you know, the main...
Yeah.
You know that thing? So, anyway, finally it's about 9 o'clock and we said, come on into the den, kids. What, Mom? We don't want to come. Well, no, come on. We're going to talk. So they come in, you know, and they just throw themselves on the couch, and only one of them wanted to be there, of course the youngest. But they were just, like, acting like they were falling asleep. They were just, I'm laughing about it now, but at that time, I got really upset. I felt like, boy, I'm really not being valued. This isn't important to them. They don't even want to be with me. All they want is for me to give to them, and then they can just, like, go off and do their own thing. And I just got very upset at the kids for that, and thought that I was, you know, really right in doing that. And I think on one hand, it really is appropriate for children to learn to be kind, to learn to respect their parents and their wishes, and to learn from their parents. And I agree with that. And that's though what I just wanted to hang on to last night. And my husband, so I kind of got into it with one of my children, and my husband just kind of said later, you know, Christine, you were really going off on that child. Don't want to name the child because they wouldn't like that on the radio. But I just got mad at him, and I stomped out of the room. What do you mean? These kids are being disrespectful. And I went to bed, and this morning I thought, okay, wait a minute. Okay, so the kids were wrong, but so was I. I was wrong in the way that I approached it with them, and I was wrong in the way that I responded to my husband. And so those are the two truths that are uncomfortable to me and that I don't want to look at. But it's the prompting of the Spirit in my life that makes me, darn it, always have to come back and look at what I did that's wrong. I don't want to have to look at what I did that's wrong. I don't want to have to see it. I want just to make my child wrong, my husband wrong, and me right. And that's it.
Yeah, that's a good example of that what you're calling the prompting of the Spirit, that's why you're calling it a partnership. Because there are those voices, those urges, those things in you that say, Christine, don't ignore this.
Christine,
yeah,
Christine, wake up.
Earth,
don't
Christine.
Don't go to sleep easily.
Yeah. And then he's bidding me to respond to that. And you're right, I can go a long way toward running from that. And we do sometimes, just for long periods of time, just refuse to do what I know I'm ultimately going to have to do, is take a look at myself. That's all part of the dynamic of sanctification, the dialectic between me and the Spirit of God, as I stiff arm him and he stiff arms me, and in the end he always wins. If we are truly children of God. And in that sense, yeah, it's very helpful to see it as a partnership. And I have my part to play. I need to decide to be open to learning, open to wisdom, open to understanding.
And open to learning and open to understanding in my life, and I think most people's life, is having this willingness to fight through it. Mm-hmm. And not just to give in passively to, oh, maybe they'll forget, or no, it wasn't really that big a deal, or... But let the fight go on in me. Let it bother me that I was wrong.
Yeah.
Let me have to struggle with, I'm not so great. You understand what I mean by that? That mm-hmm. I'm not just all right. That not everybody else isn't to blame. But it's a struggle for me to give in finally and say, okay, so my son did some things wrong, my husband, I think, did a great job with it. But I would really like to blame him. Mm-hmm. And... I actually accomplished that last night. As kind as he was trying to be with me, I found big fault in him. But the fight is not giving into that. It's being willing to keep on coming back and looking at what I don't want to see.
Right, right.
What I'm really committed to not seeing. What might be scary to see. What might hurt to see. What might grieve me to see. What might humble me to see, because I have to go back and say I was wrong. Okay, we were talking about this whole idea that the world is passing away.
the biblical concept of worldliness has to do with thinking that this world is what God gave me as a wonderful gift to fill my life up with. And that's a very plausible suggestion, because, or a very plausible attitude and perspective, because God did fill this world, this creation, with a lot of wonderful things, a lot of gifts, a lot of things that are very rewarding and very joy-inducing kinds of things. But, as I've been trying to suggest, none of the joy that this world brings is really a lasting, permanent, really complete and filling kind of joy. The mistake of worldliness, what the Bible calls worldliness, is when I allow myself to believe the lie that I must find my fulfillment, my real and ultimate fulfillment, in the stuff of this world. That's a significantly different concept of worldliness than I think a lot of Christians might have, where they tend to see worldliness as just what the Bible would call licentiousness, living unprincipled lives. So the only people who really are worldly are the people who are given over to partying and drunkenness and hedonism and the pursuit of pleasure. Those are the worldly people. But we talked in our last session about people who, in the context of their religion, in the context of their faith in Jesus, are actually fundamentally worldly people, because their whole attitude toward Jesus is, Jesus came into the world to make my life here and now in the world full and complete, and to fix it for me so that it could give me the desire of my heart. And if you were to say to them, well, you know what, Jesus never promised that, it's not unusual to get a response from such Christians, well, then what good is Jesus? If Jesus doesn't come and make it so that I can have the desire of my heart in this life, then what good is Jesus? Well, that's that very question, that very reaction, is a worldly response, because it has already bought the lie, it has already bought the deception that my fulfillment is to be rooted in this world here and now. And what John is clearly saying here, I think, in 1 John, when he says the world is passing away and also its desires, but the one who does the will of God abides forever, the point that he's making is, it's the one who's invested in something that goes above and beyond and past this world that's going to last forever. The one who invests himself in this world is going to have all of their desires collapse with the very world itself. And remember the context here. He says that because when he, in response to or to support his idea, don't love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. You know, he recognizes that your perception of the world is going to make all the difference in the world as to where you turn your heart. If you look at the world and you deceive yourself into thinking the world is really substantial, it's permanent, it's there, and I can root myself in it and find my fulfillment in it, he says, then you're going to love the world. That your choices are going to be toward the world. Your choices are going to be, I want my comfort, I want my fulfillment, I want my blessing to come out of that world. If you look at the world and you realize, boy, that's not going to last long and it's not very substantial, then you turn and look for the alternative. Who is substantial? Where can I turn my heart? Where can I turn my affection? Where can I turn my love to something that's not going to go away on me and collapse on me? And you find it in the Father, in God.
And that's where the verse in Psalms makes sense. Delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart.
Exactly. That's exactly right, yeah.
I do get the desire of my heart, but not through worldliness.
Right.
I get my desires of my heart through delighting myself in the Lord, through tuning my eyes to who He is and what He wants and what His values are and how He wants me to be and who He wants me to be and how He wants me to see.
And I clearly think David there recognizes that what I really delight or what I really want that is the delight of my heart is not going to be realized here and now under the sun in this world, but it's ultimately going to be realized in my life. And I think David understands that. It's our worldliness that looks at a verse like that, and because we want so desperately for it to say, delight yourself in the Lord, and you're going to get what you want out of this world here and now in this lifetime. That's what we want that verse to mean. And in my worldliness, I take a verse like that and I interpret it that way. I distort its meaning.
In his article, Treasuring These Things in Our Hearts, Jack Crabtree reflects on two aspects of the Christmas story that just don't make sense. On the one hand, the birth of Jesus is accompanied by a dramatic fanfare of angels singing, ordinary people prophesying as to Christ's identity and significance, and wise men traveling from the other side of the world to do homage to him. On the other hand, when Jesus begins his public ministry years later, he emerges from relative obscurity to present himself to a skeptical nation that didn't seem to have the slightest idea who he was and what he had come to do. How can the public be so utterly without a clue as to who Jesus is when God made it so clear with events surrounding his birth? In this article, Jack discusses how easy it is to believe that Jesus is the promised king because a whole chorus of angels are singing his praises in a dramatic display of divine power. However, it is much more difficult to believe that Jesus is the promised king when life's circumstances are closing in on you, when you have lived for years with no solutions to your most urgent problems, when angels are conspicuously silent, when God seems so far away, so preoccupied, and so deaf, and when no signs in the heavens are telling you anything at all. Jack stresses that if we believe deeply and profoundly within our own hearts that what is transpiring at Christmas is the most important thing the world will ever know, then truly we have come to believe in the importance of Christmas. Call the McKinsey Study Center for your free copy of the article, Treasuring These Things in Our Hearts, by Jack Crabtree.
So, Jack, how do you, in your life, share in this work that God is doing in your life to make you non-worldly? How do you work toward being a spiritual man?
Well, that's a good question.
I just gave an example out of my life where there was this big conflict. And is that the same kind of thing that happens in your life, or how do you see it happening?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. See myself making foolish choices, doing foolish things, reacting in ways that are inappropriate, and then...
Okay, so tell us one. Tell on yourself, Jack. Because I'm asking you this because people will think, yeah, well, they just kind of do little foolish things, but I do this big foolish thing. They would never do that. Yes, we would.
Well, this may only be tangentially related to the actual specific point that I'm making here. It will fulfill your request
to my tell demand. Myself,
your demand that I tell on myself, but I don't want people to get confused by trying to see me illustrating the actual specific point that I'm making. Although it's not unrelated, it's not immediately obvious how it's related. I've been in the ministry now in one capacity or another for virtually all of my adult life. I mean, when I graduated from college, instead of going on to graduate school right away, I went into an intern program in a church in California. And my desire was just to learn something about the Bible and learn something more about my faith. But one thing led to another, and I ended up joining the pastoral staff and really basically entering into the ministry, kind of through the back door. I was married during the course of my internship at that church. And from the very beginning, I have done some things that have been very, very hurtful to my wife. Devastating is not an exaggeration. I mean, I have devastated her. I have treated her very cruelly. Not cognizant that I was doing that.
Not aware that
I was doing that. But when through talking to her, I could look back at it and see it through her eyes, I realized how just horrible I had been. You know, specifically, I would teach evening classes early on, and I was young and had more energy, and so it would not be unusual for me to stay after class and talk to people till 1:30, 2:30, even 3 o'clock in the morning. And we didn't have any children at that time. My wife would be home all alone, would wake up at 1:30 in the morning wondering where I was, had imagined that I was by the side of the road bleeding to death or something like that, had no way of contacting me, and would just get very, very fearful and worried about me. I'd eventually come home and she'd be you know, that combination of relieved but
angry.
Really angry at the same time. And so we talk about her anger. And early on, I was very defensive. I didn't, this doesn't mean that I don't care for you. I'm not choosing them over you. All those things that she was feeling and all those things that she was struggling with, you know, just try to talk her out of it and tell her that it doesn't mean what you say that it means. And I really fought seeing what I was doing through her eyes. I just wouldn't see it through her eyes. And I think largely the reason that I wouldn't see it through her eyes is because I didn't look quite so good through her eyes. If I saw myself through my eyes, I looked a whole lot better. I was serving God. I was being faithful. I was doing the ministry. I was being loving. I was being kind to these other people. I was a servant to these other people. And I looked good. But when I looked at myself through her eyes, I looked like someone who had a vested interest in looking good in the eyes of other people, even if that meant actually being incredibly thoughtless in relationship to my wife. And the idea that I was that thoughtless was not a comfortable idea. But, you know, I fought it, I was defensive, I struggled with it. But in the end, I came to realize she's right. You know, what's really going on here? What's really going on here is I'm being a whole lot more selfish than I will admit. And this is not just about serving God. This is about looking good. This is about looking like a nice guy in the eyes of other people, trying to build my reputation and protect my reputation in the eyes of other people at the expense of the one that I'm most committed to and the one that is my dearest friend. At her expense, I'm insisting on looking good to other people. And it took me a while to admit that, but it was true.
How long is a while? Was it years?
Well, I think I've realized it at different levels. I think a matter of months, I came to finally be willing to acknowledge that there was some truth in what she was saying. But then it really took me years to realize how profoundly true that was, I think. And have I stopped it? No, because the problem goes so deep. It's not that I'm choosing to be thoughtless. Being thoughtless comes naturally to me. I'm profoundly and deeply a sinner. And so if I make choices without really thinking about it, I'm likely to make choices that are just as self-serving as they've ever been. Yet when she points it out to me, I don't fight it quite as hard because I've been there before and I've learned that truth and I recognize that it really is a reality. But I can't, like some people say, you know, I figured out what I was doing wrong and I stopped it. I'm sure if you watched me, you'd see me making the same mistakes over and over and over again.
And that matters too, that you make the mistake?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I've come to see what a, you know, the very cruel effect in the lives of other people that I'm so thoughtless.
And does that have any impact in your trying to think about it? Trying not to do it? Trying to work?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, that when I can when I can slow down and try to think, okay, now what should I do? What would the right thing to do? Now I bring into that perspective, you know, what about your family? What about your wife? What's the right and good thing to do for her in a way that I wouldn't have even, it wouldn't have even been part of my deliberation early on.
Mm-hmm. So you're not saying in any way that you're being passive about it or that it doesn't matter that you're thoughtless and selfish. It matters.
Oh, it matters a great deal. I hope it's true. It may not be true enough, but I hope it's true that I just find who I am in that respect truly abhorrent, and that the cry of my heart, if not my lips, that the cry of my heart is, God save me.
It is devastating to look at ourselves, isn't it? I find it quite devastating to look at my own selfishness over and over and over again.
Right. Oh, it's not easy. We fight it. We really fight it long and hard. Like, and you know, I get angry. I talked about being defensive. Mm-hmm. You know, I turned my anger at her. She's not understanding me. She's not respecting what I'm doing. She's really misunderstanding me. Well, actually, she was understanding me more profoundly than I was understanding myself. Mm-hmm. But I was accusing her of misunderstanding me. Mm-hmm. I really love God a whole lot more than you realize is what I was saying. Well, that was just nonsense. I didn't love God enough, but I was blind. You know, I didn't see it. Now, let me relate this to the point of this particular session, that is worldliness. What I was doing was ultimately worldly, because I was more interested in my reputation here and now in this world, the people that were present right now. My reputation in their eyes was more important to me than really my reputation in God's eyes. You know, was I really right? Was I really good? Was I really an upright individual? Or did I just come across that way to the people that I was interacting with day in and day out? That's ultimately a worldly perspective. In fact, it's a subset of worldliness that gets talked about a number of times in the New Testament. It's to fear man rather than fear God.
It's kind of the bottom line.
It's pretty basic. It's pretty foundational.
Yeah, if we want to try and find something going on in our life, try our selfishness, I think, or try and see our selfishness. So often, Jack, it comes down to the fear of men, which is how we look in other people's eyes and wanting to look good.
Yeah.
It comes out to that just a whole lot. And I think profoundly, I want to look good in my own eyes. I am an audience unto myself.
That's right.
And that's what you were saying in regard to this situation with you and Jody. You just didn't want to, you were defensive and angry because you didn't want to see yourself as a selfish sinner. You wanted to see yourself as a godly, spiritual man.
Right.
And
right.
That's what we all want.
Yeah.
See ourselves, maybe I wouldn't call it, like a non-believer wouldn't say that, but they would want to see themselves as good or right or...
important.
Valuable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jack, I really appreciate you sharing that particular example. Lots of people that I work with have a real huge problem, especially if there's one person that is working in an outside job and another person that's at home with the children. Typically, it's a woman at home and the man that's outside. I work with a lot of professional people who are doing important and valuable jobs and who are really actually helping people out there. And when their spouse says to them, "You're working too much, you're staying too late, you're gone a lot," they just can't get it because they're doing good stuff out there. And they just think their wife is not being supportive, or their whatever spouse it is just not being supportive. And it's very, very tough for them to see this particular point. And I think most people would look at it and say, "No, I'm not. I'm not being selfish. That's not really what's going on." But what I often encourage people to do is to watch their reaction to their spouse saying, "Wait a minute, you're doing too much." If their reaction is anger, defensiveness, blaming, manipulation, you know, dig your heels in, then probably that's a sign that says you ought to look. Not a sign that you're right, but take another look at yourself. Because if it isn't really an issue, we don't have a tendency to clench our fists tight. We can open our hands and understand and look and relate to the other person because we're not defending against something we don't want to see.
Right. Yeah.
See the logic?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, and I think that's something that kind of intuitively I've begun to see in my own life, is that when I get defensive, when I get angry like that, it's almost a surefire sign that I'm fighting something that I need to see. I wouldn't be angry if I weren't working hard to not see what's true.
Now, Jack, there's this worldliness that's in all of us. Are we suggesting to people that they look at all their choices, all their actions all day long? Recently, someone came up to me and said, "You know, I've been listening to your radio program, and Christine, you can't possibly mean that I need to be that observant of my life." My answer, Jack, would be, yeah, I think we do need to be quite observant of our lives. Certainly, we can't look at every action and every choice all the time. There's just too much going on. But as a general commitment to life, we need to be, as you said, ruthlessly honest with ourselves, and that means observing and looking at our behavior, our choices, our attitudes.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see what people would object to if they thought we were saying that we just need to be hyper introspective, for example. That's not really realistic, I think, because you know, so much of my life I just need to do it, and I don't really have the time, I don't have the leisure, the luxury of being able to watch myself do it and observe and analyze what it is that I'm doing. And I think you would agree with that.
Absolutely.
It's just not possible to do that. But the really important thing is, do I have the commitment to that honesty so that when I do have the opportunity to see, and sometimes to take the opportunity to just sit down and kind of analyze who I am and what I'm doing would be perfectly appropriate. But even if I don't do that, I think God has a way of just kind of sticking something in my face and saying, look at it. Well, when he sticks something in my face and says, look at it, what am I going to see? Am I going to see what's there, or am I going to avert my gaze and insist that what he wants me to look at isn't the way that it really is? It's that commitment to honesty that's far more important than introspection. I mean, I'm not asking anybody become a very introspective person. I'm asking them to become a very honest person.
And that does include some introspection.
Yeah, at times it certainly will. And must.
It did for you in your example. You had to sit down, perhaps, and consider what Jody was trying to tell you. And it certainly did for me last night. After, you know, I fought it in myself. I didn't want anybody to be right. I wanted me to be right. And, you know, I did have to take some time. I did have to think about it. So it's
but you were sort of driven to that, weren't you? I mean, the circumstances and the relationships and everything created a kind of
momentum.
Yeah, and a turmoil that needed some sort of resolution. Mm-hmm. And it's the resolution that you knew one way or the other. You needed to resolve, you know, what's going on, what's happening here, who's right, who's wrong. Answering those questions forced you to a kind of introspection.
There is this further introspection that I have when these kind of things come up. And I think about, where did that come from? What's that about? What's that mean about me? What's that say about how I understand God? What's that say about how I'm committed to loving my children or loving my husband? Those kinds of questions come up, and I work with them a lot. If that's introspection, then that's, I think, well, I'm very committed to that's good introspection. That helps me continue to see and to understand and to gain more knowledge of things, more wisdom. And it also helps me make changes that I need to make. If I don't just make it a fleeting, oh yeah, I did wrong, but I take it seriously.
Yeah. I know when I was trying to sort some of these things out earlier in my life, when people would talk about the profundity of my selfishness or the depth of sin or something like that, I mistook what people were saying, and I thought that they were saying, you know, everything that you do is suspect and touched by sin. And so everything I do, I need to analyze and scrutinize. So I'd walk in the room and somebody would say, hi, how are you? And I'd say, I'm just fine, thank you. And then I need to stop there and analyze what it is, how I just reacted to them. And, you know, what's really going on and what's really at the heart of how I responded.
Now that would make you crazy.
Yeah, it would make you crazy.
Yeah.
And that might be an extreme example, but that's the kind of introspection that some people feel like we are encouraging them to. Just live your life twice all the time. Live it in parallel. And I wouldn't advocate that, and I don't think you are either. But certainly those moments of reflection where we just ask ourselves, who are we? What are my relationships supposed to be all about? And how am I doing with that? And who am I in relationship to that? Yeah, we have to be aware and learn from our life experience, not just, as I said earlier, skip along the surface and not think about it. We should be thoughtful people. I don't see how we can be children of God and not be thoughtful people, reflective people.
And sometimes, Jack, what that requires is that I slow down. That, you know, I was taken up last night in the momentum and this morning in the momentum of the issues. But there are times also that I just sit and reflect. I think about, or I write about, or I draw. to help myself understand what's going on in my life. Some people do artwork for that, but it's some people just sit. Some people have a favorite chair. Some people walk and think. But I think that slowing down, getting away from the pace of life, is extremely helpful to be thoughtful people. I cannot be a thoughtful person if I'm going 110 miles an hour all the time. It's not going to happen.
And in fact, if you don't want to be a thoughtful person, that's a good
strategy.
That's
a great idea.
Yeah.
Strategy for avoiding it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's our chosen, pretty much our chosen strategy, at least here in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, it looks good to go fast and get a lot accomplished and be successful, and you don't have to feel inadequate or scared or...
Because there's no time for it.
There's no time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jack, I want to press you a little bit more with examples, because I think this really helps people, and I really want to go for it.
Okay.
With helping people understand really what committing ourselves to worldliness or committing ourselves to God looks like. I asked you to give an example in your life, and you gave a really great example that I think is incredibly helpful, I think, especially to people who have professions and perhaps specifically to people who are in the ministry in some way. Can you give me a more current example of yourself in your life now? I would like you, if you would be willing to give one in regard to your parenting. That's such a big issue. It's such a hard issue for so many of us. And it looks like from the outside that for a lot of people, they have such good children. Their children are doing so well. It must mean that the parents are just really, really doing a great job. And I don't think there are any parents that are really doing a great job. There could be children who have easier dispositions than others. But we as parents need to be supporting each other by talking about what we're doing that's in our parenting that's worldly, to support each other so we don't think we have to have it all together.
I'm not sure this is exactly what you're looking for, but to want children to look good is once again a worldly attitude.
Because I want them to look good for me.
For me.
To look good.
Exactly. It comes back to that reputation and the fear of man, again, is how my children look in the eyes of other people and how that reflects indirectly on me is what I'm really, really interested in. Never mind what God is doing. Never mind what would really be ultimately eternally productive in the lives of my children. I just want them to reflect well on me, and that's my main agenda. That can be very destructive, because what that means is, as a parent, I'm sorely tempted to manipulate and control my kids' behavior. I don't want to confront the real life issues in their life. I just want them to shape up and behave in a certain way so that I look good.
Yes.
And I just skirt over the deeper issues that they as people before their God are wrestling with and dealing with.
Oh, that is so well said. That's exactly it. And that's the bottom line of a lot of our difficulty in our parenting. And our children feel really controlled, and they rebel against it, and we wonder why. We're just trying to do what's right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we're not.
Right.
We're blind, and we want to just look good. I'm thinking about things like you're in the ministry, and it might look really good for your children to show up at church.
Yeah. We made a choice some time ago that our children will come to church when and if they want to come to church. That's not altogether true. Sometimes we'll make a request on this particular occasion, will you come? I mean, we don't feel bad about that. We are their parents. But we don't just have a standing expectation that you will go to church. And I had to think about that a little bit. I mean, how does that look for the pastor of a church to have children that don't come to church? But what I decided is, one of my experiences in Sunday school growing up is that I got this really distinct impression that Christianity was for kids. It was childish. And when I later came to take this Christianity seriously, I realized what an incredibly faulty message that was. On the contrary, Christianity is not for kids. It's not childish. It's not infantile. Christianity is very grown up. And in fact, it's so grown up that children don't really and cannot really understand it. they're not really in a position to understand it. When your four-year-old is singing, Jesus loves me, this I know, they don't have the foggiest idea what that really means. They haven't wrestled with their sin and the profound depths of evil and come to terms with the mercy of God that forgives that and has promised them an inheritance in spite of their moral unworthiness. I mean, all that stuff that takes us years and years to really come to understand is just completely, they're completely oblivious to that. They don't know what that means. You know, that it's naive and childish. So what I decided is for our children is that I would rather have Christianity be this kind of hidden, secret, mysterious thing that they could delve into when they grew up if they wanted to. But it wasn't something I was just going to give them as a child because this is, after all, silly, childish stuff. And so far, I think it has proven to be a relatively wise course because my children have, as they have begun to grow into their adult minds and adult brains and adult experience, have chosen to be intrigued by this and begun to say, okay, it's time for me to take a look at what this thing is that's so important to my father and to my mother.
But in a sense, it isn't a secret because your life kind of oozes with your faith. It comes out in your values. It comes out in your choices. It comes out in how you relate to them. It comes out in your perspective of forgiveness, your perspective of mercy towards them. In a sense, they know one whole lot about Christianity. They have to. They just maybe don't know what verse it's found in.
Right.
Okay, we're at the end of our time. How about if you give us a summary?
Again, we're in a larger conversation over the course of several weeks about
what it looks like to be a believer.
Yeah, what it looks like when God invades my life and begins to change me and make some visible, tangible difference in my life. What does that look like? And we've talked about how my understanding of God gets changed, gets transformed. And then most recently, including today, we've been talking about how my view of reality itself, this created reality that I'm a part of, gets changed. And we've decided two things. I come to understand that this reality was not made to be my ultimate blessing and fulfillment for two reasons. One, because it's inherently incapable of doing that. It's futile. It's empty. It's hollow. And secondly, because it wasn't made to last. It's not eternal. So if I want my fulfillment, I'm going to have to look outside of this reality that I'm a part of to something beyond it, something above it, to God.
In her News and Views article, Reconciled Enemies, Mackenzie Study Center staff member Nancy Scott examines the common Christian belief that spiritual maturity depends on pursuing a personal relationship or friendship with God. She argues that the test of one's relationship with God is not whether one feels in fellowship with God. Rather, it is how one answers the question, what are we going to do with the fact that God is in charge of our lives and we are not? She states, the choices we make about how we respond to the circumstances of our lives and not whether we pursue friendship with God will ultimately attest to God's working in our lives. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Reconciled Enemies.
Jack, in thinking about asking our radio listeners for financial support for this program, an issue that comes to mind is the whole subject of tithing. Can you talk about how tithing might fit into people's giving, or maybe not fit into people's giving to this particular program?
Well, it's my persuasion that it doesn't really, is not really relevant, because I'm not sure that tithing is really a concept that you have taught in the New Testament. Tithing, I think, was a peculiar institution in the covenant that God made with Israel that really is ultimately only relevant to Israel as a nation and will be relevant to them one day again, as prophecy has it, when the Jews return to their Lord and make God their God and God can finally actively be their people, then I would expect that tithing will become a very important part of that society. But the whole purpose of tithing, I think, was to be a kind of symbol, was to be a symbolic activity in their culture to communicate their understanding that all that they have belongs to God. So the New Testament concept is not that we should tithe everything, that all of our income and all of our possessions, but rather that we should look at them in a particular way. Specifically, we should recognize that God really is the owner of everything that I have. Everything I have has been entrusted to me by its true owner. And then in that spirit, I need to spend, invest, distribute my resources as would be pleasing to God. But it's not just 10% that belongs to God, it's all of it.
So are you saying that we should give all our money to God and not have any left over to buy food?
No, I'm not saying that we should give it all away, but that we should understand that it's not for me to decide how I'm going to spend it or how I'm going to invest it or how I'm going to use it out of my own wants and desires. I always need to be asking, how would my Lord, who is the owner of all that belongs to me, how would he want me to spend it and how would he want me to use it? Buying groceries is certainly within the purview of part of what God would want me to do with it. And it may very well be in the right set of circumstances that buying a vacation home may very well be in the purview of what God would want me to do with my money. That becomes a very personal and individual decision before our Lord. I don't rule anything out necessarily, but the question is, am I even going to ask that question? Is that even an important consideration for me?
So what you're saying is that it's not just 10% of our money that belongs to God, but it's all of our money.
Yeah, I think so.
And we need to be asking the question, how would God want me to be dealing with this money? And we can really open up our blinders and say it's not just to give to missions or just to give to my church or just to give to some Christian program, but it's really wide open to what may be loving, what may be a demonstration of kindness or that may help justice.
Yeah. And that's the only absolute, is that however I spend it, is it consistent with what's right, what's just, what's true, what's good, what's loving? That's what God wants me to do with my money.
Okay, so here we are asking people to consider, as part of their thinking, is Christianity at Work the radio program that they would like to support? We would like them to ask that question. We hope so. We would like to continue the program, but we want people to honestly evaluate what's right for them to give.
But certainly we're not claiming to know that the right thing for any individual to do is to give to this ministry. That, I mean, there are plenty of godly people who are obeying God and are investing their money in the light of what God wants them to do, who will not decide to give their money to this ministry. We understand that. The main concern is that they be of the mindset that God owns all their possessions. That's the thing that is absolutely necessary. If they decide to give money to this ministry, that's great for us, and we appreciate that. But we don't by any means expect that everyone will make that decision.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center. Thank you for listening.